There are a lot of reasons why the big banks should be behind improving financial literacy for Canadians, but there are also some reasons why maybe they shouldn't be. We're going to look at the potential conflicts of interest and some potential solutions. Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi there, Bruce.
You spent your entire career in communications, most recently as the chief communications officer at TD Bank. What are some of the differences that you notice now that you're outside of the bank itself, but in an organization that represents the banks?
Well, there are huge differences. I mean, at the Canadian Bankers Association, we represent 64 banks. So people think of my job as working with the big five banks, but I actually work with 64 banks coast to coast. That's both domestic, the large ones, the smaller domestics, and then the foreign banks.
Most important question I can ask at this point is, how many kids growing up in your family? Do you have experience dealing with this?
I have two.
Two. So you're one of three?
Oh, sorry.
No, when you were a kid.
When I was a kid, I'm an only child.
You're an only child.
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe that gives you a refreshing perspective on that, because I feel like I'm the youngest of five kids. I would have been very well prepared for squabbling amongst 64 member nations.
I'm sure you probably were. Yeah.
I was. Now, Canadian banks, they are strong, they are powerful, and they are profitable. When it comes to financial literacy, you could say, to whom much is given, much is expected.
Absolutely.
What is the role for the banks when it comes to financial literacy?
Well, I mean, the truth is, financial literacy is one of those terms that, I don't love, notwithstanding the fact
that— We share that. We have that in common.
Notwithstanding the fact I sit on the National Steering Committee for Financial Literacy. And the reason really is that it's binary, right? It denotes you're either literate or illiterate.
Right.
And I view financial education is just that. It's a journey, and it should start when you're a child, and it should continue your entire life, right? Past post-retirement, I think there's still opportunity to learn. So I think the banks, in answer to your question, have a huge role to play in not only providing information, but arming customers with the right questions to ask to continue that education journey.
We're going to talk about some conflicts, as I foreshadowed, but at CBA, you've got two demographics that you've been doing some work in the area of, seniors and high school students.
Yes.
Let's start with the students. What's the program? How does it work?
It's a seminar, and it's a non-commercial seminar, so it's given on a volunteer basis by bankers from across the country. And so what would happen is a teacher or a principal school board would request a seminar, and it's really aimed at 15-year-olds, but it's designed to give them the 101 in terms of budgeting, how to spot and be cognizant of fraud, particularly debit card fraud, and then a little bit on the responsible use of credit.
Mm. You have a 13-year-old, not quite 15, but 13.
I do.
One of the things that I think is going to be really important for me as a parent getting to that age is addressing peer pressure, because so much of the consumption, sure, it comes from social media and advertising and all that stuff, yeah, but it also comes from the kids sitting next to you in history class saying, oh, yeah, this is what I have. What do you have? How do you think that fits within a financial literacy context?
Well, I think it's critical, and this is one of the things that, you know, when I talk about financial education, I think we have to look at those things in totality. I think often we look at, we'll just provide more information and more resources, but I think you can scan, you know, pick a bank, pick the CBA, the FCAC, there's a variety of government agencies that have all kinds of information on there, but I think what is perhaps an area for improvement is to address what you're talking about, which is a real life situation. You mentioned my 13-year-old, and to be sure, she's the spender. I have two girls. I have a spender and a saver.
You already have noticed the temperament difference.
Absolutely. Since they were very young, one of the things I've offered both my girls is that, you know, when you get that $10 birthday money, if you deposit that money or whatever you deposit in a bank account, in a savings account, I'll double.
You'll double it.
I'll double it. And
where does one get those kinds of returns? That's even better than
return.
An RESP.
And what I've noticed is my young one, if she gets $10 worth of birthday money from her grandparents, she will scour the house for loose change to turn the $10 into $10, $50, or $11. And she wants the $11 doubled, not the $10. at best, my eldest will take her $10 and spend at least eight of it, and I'm doubling $2 and $3 and $4.
Really? So your younger one's going to be trading commodities by the time she's 15.
Well, my joke is she's going to be the landlord, and she's definitely the strict one. If the rent money's not there on the first, right, it'll be out on the street.
I hope she cuts you some slack on your rent when you're a senior.
So do I.
So students are one big demographic. The other is seniors,
yes,
and this is relevant for the seniors themselves, of course, but it's also relevant for my generation, Gen Xers, who are seeing our smart, capable, wonderful parents aging into a phase of life in which they're less, you know, they're less focused on some of these logistical things for a bunch of reasons.
Absolutely. And that's really the design of the program. It's a newer program for us at the Canadian Bankers Association. But to your point, many seniors have lived their entire lives one way, which is, you know, they want to buy that first home, they got their mortgage, then they want to pay down the debt, and they're saving for retirement. And they've got, in terms of cash flow, they've got that paycheck or whatever it is, and everything is by and large steady year after year after year. And all of a sudden, all the dynamics change when they retire, and perhaps they're having to, you know, they're on more of a fixed income or they're on a different income source. And they're facing different challenges. A big part of the program that we have for seniors is to highlight what's an unfortunate problem in Canada, one that we think, if left unaddressed, will continue to grow, and that's elder financial abuse.
Mm-hmm.
That's whether they be a victim of fraud from fraudsters, but sometimes, frankly, can even be friends or family taking advantage of people.
And there's a fairly, nebulous definition of what fraud actually means when it's family members, in that there can be a tacit agreement that I'm the one who takes care of mom, so therefore I get some money for gas money, or I get $1,000 a month for providing those services. It's not like the huckster who knocks on the door and steals $100 from her purse.
Yeah, exactly. You've just captured it. And really, you know, I know a big theme and what I think is so great about shows like this one is getting people to talk about something that is inherently personal. And perhaps if we talk about different generations in particular, they might be uncomfortable with. But it's important. As you said, when there are these unwritten rules about I do this and as a result I get this payment or I get access to this, that's where families, you know, resentment can grow. You mentioned siblings.
Yeah.
And that's an obvious place. So I think the more that can be done to actually encourage people to have a conversation and be open and honest with one another, I think the better. I think when things are hidden, when there's not light on them, that's where resentment can grow. And frankly, unfortunately, people can be taken advantage of.
How do you factor in cognitive decline? And that isn't to reinforce the stereotype that seniors are starting to lose it. But
yeah,
there is a difference in the hardware for someone, yeah, who's 80 or 90 years old than there is for someone who's 30 or 40.
Absolutely. And it's a very fair point. I think when you look at powers of attorney, when you look at options that need to be documented with a financial planner, I think those are the sorts of conversations that need to happen. And again, I think what you want to do is start off with a plan, but also give yourself some degree of flexibility to understand that circumstances might change. You know, health can change, not only mental health, but physical health as well. And to ensure that people are protected, both for their own sake, but ultimately for their families as well.
We've talked about some of the easy areas when it comes to financial literacy. And when I say easy, I mean there's no conflict. Let's teach our kids stuff. Let's take care of our seniors and arm them in the risk of abuse and fraud. But there are some areas that are more difficult to talk about when it comes to financial literacy, given the competing interests of the individual and the institutions. What are some of those areas that leap to mind, where they're just like, oh, how do we navigate that?
Well, I think, you know, it can often happen in areas like credit, where there's, you know, how do you ensure, I think when some people hear the word financial literacy, we already talked about how I'm not a big fan of that term, but I think when some people hear financial literacy, what they really think is marketing. They think you're trying to get in front of people, whether they be youth or other groups, and entice them to dependency on credit or other financial products. And I think that's a legitimate concern. It's something that needs to be watched. It's certainly something that we take quite seriously at the CBA. But I think that's often where there can be some inherent conflicts, is are you truly helping them understand how to build effective credit and use it appropriately, or are you just sort of luring them to a product?
I've used this example before, but if I think about the two Bruces that there could be the Bruce who's financial education guy, and he wants everyone to pay off their credit card in full every single month, no matter what. There could be a Bruce who held the P&L responsibility at a big bank for that particular part of the lending portfolio, who, provided the defaults aren't horrific, wants Canadians to carry a balance. And the last number I saw was an outstanding balance of somewhere around $3,000 or something like that. How do you true those two things? How do you bring those two things together? Because they're diametrically opposed.
Yep.
If every single Canadian paid off their credit card, that would be bad for the banks.
Well, I think, you know, starting off, as you said, there's about 60% of Canadians pay off their credit card debt in full every month. And so that obviously means there's about 40% or so that aren't. I think I hear the argument, and certainly that's a concern for people. I think what you look at in terms of most banks is they're taking a holistic approach to their relationship with the customer. And if your objective is product by product to take advantage of a customer, you're ultimately not going to be in a good place in terms of your overall relationship with the customer. And so I think some might argue that's a cynical view. I certainly understand why people could draw that conclusion. I tend to view that as a cynical view. But I do think that, by and large, most banks are interested in the total financial health of their customer. Look, banks aren't in the business of lending money. They don't think they're going to be paid back. And particularly as it pertains to credit cards, which is an unsecured product, there is greater risk with that, so they're going to want to ensure that customers are repaying that.
It's paid back, because it's only $3,000. It's not a big deal, and people who carry a $3,000 balance have a pretty good credit score. So it's not a risk of default. It's more that they're earning money on the interest on that outstanding balance, which, if we took a pure financial education approach, we'd have people eliminate overnight. And, you know, on your website, there actually isn't anything about the problems of credit cards. There's the stats that you talked about, the benefits for consumers, the benefits for retailers. But from an education standpoint, there isn't anything that says, here are the numbers. If you carry $3,000 for an entire year, here's what it costs you. And if you just were able to pay that off, that would be so much more beneficial to you.
Yeah, I think you've seen, and there's been some real enhancements over the years in terms of credit card statements, in terms of making clear to customers what the true costs are in terms of carrying a balance and what the alternatives are and how long it would take to pay off the balance if you were to only pay the monthly minimum. So is there work to be done? Are there areas for improvement? Surely. But I think directionally things are going the right way in terms of responsible use of credit by Canadians.
Here's another tough area is mortgage affordability. So when you do the calculation or you talk to any lender, whether it's a bank or a mortgage broker, and you talk about the affordability question, really what they're answering is how much can you afford without defaulting? Because we think about, not to say that they don't love their customers and all that stuff, but they don't spend an enormous amount of time talking to the client about all the other things that may require cash from that person over the course of their life. They come into the house of affordability through very different doors. How do you reconcile that?
Again, I think what's a huge opportunity for banks, and you're starting to see them make some pretty big inroads in doing it, is this concept of advice. And again, in your words, taking a total picture of the customer's obligations and ensuring that housing affordability meets a test, not that's a pass-fail binary once again, but taken in concert with all of the other obligations you have. Is this a payment you'd be comfortable making? And I think that lenders have a responsibility to play in that, as do the borrowers.
The CBA has been engaged in financial literacy from a measurement perspective. You've got an evaluation tool trying to test the efficacy of some of these programs out there. What have you found from that early work?
It is very early, and we've done some great work with Prosper Canada and the FCAC on this front. It really starts with trying to get a more common understanding about what success looks like and a common sense set of metrics for people to evaluate their financial literacy programs. But we're early in that process, and I think we're expecting to see a lot more results by the end of this year.
Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association. The focus of our conversation is financial literacy. And one of the real challenges, I think, is the Canadians' perception of the banks, which you were at TD when a particular set of stories came out from the CBC about sales practices at the bank. What kind of hit did the banks take in terms of trust?
You know, I think much of the evidence that I saw in terms of overall reputational risk surveys and pollings show that the impact wasn't as great as you might expect. That certainly there was a fair amount of noise, particularly concentrated in a small number of media outlets. But at the end of the day, and if you talk to our members, both large and small, they tell you the same thing, that the allegations made in many of those media accounts weren't reflective of the reality at the institutions themselves.
Why aren't in-branch employees called sales consultants? And I asked because, so as that story was unfolding in Canada, I went into my local telecom store to get a new bloody phone. And I was all set. I knew I was going to be sold because that's, you know, yeah. I had to go get a new phone. So there was a new contract. And the person's name tag said sales consultant. Given the focus on selling, which I don't think is a bad thing, by the way, but given the focus on selling in a branch, why not call them sales consultants?
You know, I think you're going to run the gamut bank to bank. And so it's difficult to give an industry perspective on those. I know some still call their frontline employees tellers. Others don't. They're
financial services representatives.
They have a variety. So it's difficult to have sort of an industry standardization on that. And it really does change bank to bank.
What do you think, where do you think the trade-offs need to be made on some of these conflicts that I've highlighted? If it's mortgage affordability, if it's the fee discussion on mutual funds, if it's credit cards, what are the trade-offs?
You know, it's difficult for me with a great deal of precision to sort of say, you know, it should be this, or it should be that. I think what's most important is that you take a holistic view of the customer beginning to end, from the banking side to whatever products they have, if they have a wealth relationship, and that anytime you're looking at your relationship with a customer solely based on a product set, that's not serving the customer well and ultimately not serving the bank well.
How do you approach the growth of fintech in Canada, which I know is an enormous topic? We could talk about it for days.
I'd love to do that for days.
Yeah. But if we were talking to Terry Campbell or Nancy or Ray Prati or any of your predecessors a decade ago, fintech was not a word. We wouldn't have talked about it. It just would not have been on the radar in any respect. This is going to be a huge challenge for your members in the future.
And I also say a huge opportunity.
Yeah.
I think years ago, the narrative on fintech was, you know, they're the ultimate disruptors. They're going to come in and they're going to eat the bank's lunch, and they're going to take over. I'd say in general, what fintech does exceptionally well is solve customer pain points. And if you think about other industries where technology's moved in a disruptive way, that's what they've done. They've solved a pain point for a customer, whether it's how I pay or how I order a service or where it's available. As it pertains to banking, what they often lack, it starts with trust. So it's usually a brand new name, a new brand. And so there's no relationship of trust, which is ultimately what banking is all about. And there's certainly not often extensive balance sheets, fraud management, liquidity, risk management programs. And those are the things banks bring. And so I think where you've seen fintech be most powerful and most successful, and I expect will be the trend that will continue, is where fintech and banks partner and bring new capability and new services to customers. And the customers ultimately get the best of both worlds. They get the customer experience they want, but they know that the bank is ultimately there in terms of its strength and solid balance sheet.
There's one factor you didn't mention about consumers. We're so lazy. We're so lazy. So if I can get kind of the service that I get at my current institution, I may not go to a fintech because I'm too darn lazy. I have one last question for you. Canadian banks are profitable. They have a strong reputation globally. What would you say are the top three priorities for you at the CBA? Now, you should have been prepared for this question in your job interview. So I think it shouldn't be new.
I did okay, I guess.
I guess. Part, you got the job.
Without doubt, and we just talked on it, is that much of the legislative framework governing the banks was written decades ago and was based on the premise of ink and paper and physical pieces of plastic in the forms of identification that you need to show up to a branch to fulfill whatever purchases or new products you want. And so I think, you know, sometimes people say, you know, the banks need to innovate. I want to be able to do this all on my mobile phone. I want to be able to do it digitally. The technology exists today. That will exist today. What doesn't exist is the legal framework to actually be able to do some of those things. So that's number one on my agenda. I'd say number two, and in a related vein, is cybersecurity is a big area of concern for the banks. And so if you are going to move things more digitally, and we talked about the importance of trust, you need to ensure that consumers can remain assured that their information is going to be kept secure. I'd say the third one really is we're in the midst of a payments modernization program that Payments Canada is leading, which is really exciting, but is also quite ambitious in terms of how we move money, what capabilities will exist, who will govern it, who has voting rights over those things. And so payments modernization will be another key priority for me.
Neil, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
You have signed up for a big, crazy
job. I have, but I'm excited about it.
Okay, that's good. Neil Parmenter is the president and CEO of the Canadian Bankers Association.